Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On May 19, 2008, the Supreme Court decided Kentucky Department of Revenue versus Davis. The court held that a state may tax interest income from bonds issued by other state and local governments, while exempting interest income from in-state bonds without violating the Commerce Clause. Professor Brandon Denning of the Cumberland School of Law, Stanford University, discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Denning.
Hello. My name is Brandon Denning. I'm a professor of law at the Cumberland School of Law at Stanford University in Birmingham, Alabama. And today I'm going to be talking about a recent Supreme Court case, Department of Revenue versus Davis. Davis is a case that I did an earlier podcast about right after oral arguments were heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. And on May 19th of this year, the court handed down its decision in Davis. As was widely expected, the court upheld Kentucky's exemption from income tax for state-issued bonds issued either by the state or by its political subdivisions. In this podcast, I'm going to describe the facts of Davis, and then before I talk about the decision itself, I'm going to back up to a decision that the court handed down last term, in the 2007 term, which really laid the foundation for the outcome of Davis and was the primary reason, I think, that Davis' outcome was almost preordained. First, the facts. The state of Kentucky, like 48 other states with an income tax, taxed the income generated by state municipal bonds. But the state exempted from tax those bonds issued by it or its political subdivisions. And again, this was an exemption that was in place in, I think, all but a single state. The Davises were Kentucky taxpayers who were taxed on the income from out-of-state bonds that they held. And the Davises sued, claiming that this blatant discrimination violated the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine's prohibition on discrimination against out-of-state commerce. This anti-discrimination principle applies equally to discriminatory taxation as well as non-tax discriminatory regulations. The trial court initially threw out their case, finding that the tax exemption was constitutional. That position was reversed by the Kentucky Court of Appeals, which found that based on the U.S. Supreme Court's existing case law, that such an exemption was unconstitutional and violated the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. The U.S. Supreme Court granted cert last spring after the Kentucky Supreme Court declined to hear the case. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed the Kentucky Appeals Court and found that the differential treatment between in-state and out-of-state bonds did not implicate the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. Now, if all you remember from the Dormant Commerce Clause from law school is that it prohibits discrimination against out-of-state goods, you might find this decision somewhat, or this holding, as I described it, somewhat puzzling. You probably remember cases like Philadelphia v. New Jersey, in which the court had struck down New Jersey's attempt to exclude out-of-state garbage from being deposited in landfills located in New Jersey. And in fact, this anti-discrimination principle has been regarded as one of the most stable and robust branches of the Dormant Commerce Clause. It's a prohibition that stretches back over a century. To understand what the court did here, it's necessary to go back and review the holding in a case called United Haulers Association, Inc. versus Oneida Herkimer Solid Waste Management Authority, or United Haulers for short. That case involved an ordinance that prohibited garbage haulers within the Oneida Herkimer County areas in upstate New York from processing the waste that they collected in the area anywhere but a publicly owned processing plant, which charged higher fees than might be available outside the Solid Waste Management Authority, except for the fact that the facility in United Haulers was publicly owned, the facts were identical to those presented by an earlier case involving a flow control ordinance called CNA Carbone versus Clarkstown. In that case, which was a 1994 case, the court struck down a so-called forced use ordinance where the plant that all the haulers were required to use was privately owned. Actually, that's a little misleading, because even though it was privately owned, it was scheduled to be turned over to the town after a period of years for a nominal fee. In any event, the court in CNA Carbone struck down the forced use ordinance and really regarded it as a fairly straightforward application of the anti-discrimination principle. In dissent, however, Justice Souter suggested that really the facility was a public one, given the rather nominal private ownership and the fact that it was slated to be turned over, sold for a nominal fee in the future. And for Justice Souter, the public nature of the facility was significant, and he thought warranted something other than this rather mechanical application of this broad anti-discrimination principle. Although Justice Souter didn't win the day in CNA Carbone, his dissent eventually became the majority opinion in United Haulers. In the United Haulers opinion, Justice Roberts, who wrote the opinion for the court, distinguished Carbone by noting that the facility here in United Haulers was owned publicly and was not a private facility. And then he went on to say that there were three reasons for not applying the anti-discrimination principle against a publicly owned facility, or rather against a law requiring all handlers, all garbage haulers, both in-state and out-of-state, to use the public facility, why that didn't violate the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine or offend the anti-discrimination principle. He basically gave three reasons. First, he noted that private and public facilities were not similarly situated, that waste collection and disposal was a traditional governmental function, and that the effects of the flow control ordinance are likely to fall upon the very people who voted for the laws, as opposed to having their costs externalized to out-of-staters who are not able to call public officials to account. Specifically, the court noted that unlike private enterprise, government is vested with the responsibility of protecting the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens, and that in executing these responsibilities, laws that favor the local government are not likely to be motivated by simple economic protectionism. The motive here in United Haulers, the court noted, was not to enrich local business, but rather force residents to internalize the cost of the waste that they generated. State and local governments ought to be able to do that, he wrote, without interference from federal courts. Second, the Chief Justice in United Haulers thought that judicial restraint was particularly appropriate here, given that the solid waste facility here, or Oneida and Herkimer counties, were executing or discharging what is usually regarded as a, quote, traditional governmental function, that is, the collection and disposal of garbage. Finally, the Chief Justice noted that the political safeguards present made judicial intervention here unnecessary. To quote him, his opinion, quote, here the citizens and businesses of the counties bear the cost of the ordinances. There is no reason to step in and hand local businesses a victory they could not obtain through the political process, close quote. Shifting back to the facts of the Davis case, it's apparent that many of the rationales the court articulated in United Haulers for not applying the anti-discrimination principle applied to Kentucky's tax exemption for bonds that it or its municipalities issued. Just to give a couple of examples. First, the use of bonds to raise funds for public projects seems to be at least as much of a traditional governmental function as the collection and disposal of garbage. Second, just as the garbage processing plant in United Haulers was publicly owned, here you're talking about a tax exemption that benefits not all in-state bonds or not all bonds issued by private businesses who locate in Kentucky, but rather simply those government bonds issued by it or its political subdivisions. In fact, in the portion of the decision that attracted a majority in Davis, the U.S. Supreme Court held just this. After describing United Haulers' holding with particular emphasis on the reasons the court gave for not extending the anti-discrimination principle to cases in which a public entity was discriminating in favor of itself, Justice Souter, who authored the majority opinion in Davis, concluded that, quote, it follows a fortiori from United Haulers that Kentucky must prevail, close quote. He went on to say that the issuance of bonds to raise revenue for public projects was as much a traditional governmental function as a collection of garbage. Thus, again, the court could presume that something more than, quote, simple economic protectionism was behind the differential tax treatment. Bond proceeds, Souter wrote, are the way to shoulder the cardinal civic responsibilities listed in United Haulers, protecting the health, safety, and welfare of citizens. The court also noted that just in United Haulers, where all in-state and out-of-state garbage haulers were required to use the local processing facility, all non-Kentucky bonds, both public and privately issued bonds, were treated the same. Justice Souter stressed that, quote, a fundamental element of dormant commerce clause jurisprudence is that entities must be similarly situated to maintain a claim for discriminatory treatment. Since no other entity, public or private, in-state or out-of-state, had the responsibility that the government of Kentucky did for the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens, Kentucky bonds could be considered, Souter concluded, in a class by themselves. As he wrote, quote, just like the ordinances upheld in United Haulers, Kentucky's tax exemption favors a traditional government function without any differential treatment favoring local entities over substantially similar out-of-state interests, close quote. Finally, the majority emphasized the distinctive character of the tax policy. All states had schemes like Kentucky's, or at least all states that had income taxes. And according to an amicus brief filed with the court, none, quote, perceives any local advantage or disadvantage beyond the permissible ones open to a government and to those who deal with it when that government itself enters the market, close quote. The court was also persuaded by the argument that, absent tax schemes like Kentucky's, small municipal borrowers might be deprived of a source of funds. The court also observed that the fact that small municipal borrowers may be disadvantaged in the absence of a tax exemption, plus the fact that this taxing practice, quote, often produces a net burden of tax revenues lost over interest expense saved, close quote, both tend to, quote, underscore how far the state's objectives probably lie from the forbidden protectionism for interstate businesses, close quote. In other words, the cost of this benefit were actually internalized by the residents and citizens of the state since, according to some economists, exemptions like Kentucky's actually cost the state more in terms of lost tax revenues than they gain in savings from interest expenses. The court also noted in passing that to have struck down Kentucky's tax exemption here would upset the expectations of the bond market, expectations that stretch back nearly a century since these exemptions have generally been available for that period of time. There was another portion of the opinion that was joined only by Justice Breyer and apparently by Justice Stevens, in which Justice Souter argued that the tax exemption could be seen as a form of market participation by Kentucky, because it was both participating in and regulating the bond market in the state. Now, you may recall that an exception to the anti-discrimination principle is the so-called market participant doctrine. The market participant doctrine permits states to favor in-state over out-of-state buyers or sellers, where the state is essentially acting as a private participant in a particular market might. To give an example, assume that a state was going to bid out the job of printing yearbooks for state universities. Just as a private business may make decisions with whom it will deal, the market participant doctrine holds that in that circumstance where the state is looking to enter the market for printing services and is expending its taxpayers' money, it may do something like require that all bids be solicited from in-state printing companies only. Similarly, suppose that a state had, at taxpayer expense, established a private business like a cement plant. The market participant doctrine holds that the state could choose to supply the cement needs of in-state citizens first before it supplied those from out-of-state. The court has traditionally, though, rejected attempts of states to invoke the market participant exception to insulate discriminatory tax exemptions or tax credits from dormant commerce clause scrutiny. In one case, Justice Scalia called the use of the taxing power a, quote, primeval governmental activity, close quote, unavailable to private market participants, and thus was market regulation, not market participation. However, in Davis, Again, in this section of the opinion that garnered only two other votes. Justice Souter seems willing to expand the market participation, at least in some circumstances, to include the use of the taxing power, at least apparently where a state is both participating in and regulating a particular market. It remains to be seen whether he will ever be able to attract two other votes necessary to see that become law. There's one other feature of the majority opinion which is worth noting. To go back to the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine generally, I've mentioned the anti-discrimination principle, but there's another tier of, or another standard of review that comes into play in Dormant Commerce Clause cases generally. And that is the so-called Pike balancing test. Balancing has been around for at least 60 years, but it's usually referred to as Pike balancing. It takes its name from a case called Pike v. Bruce Church, Inc., a 1970 case which gave sort of the canonical formulation of balancing. And says where you have a non-discriminatory law alleged to nevertheless burden interstate commerce in some way, that the challenger bears the burden of demonstrating that the burdens on interstate commerce are clearly exceeded by the, quote, putative local benefits, close quote. It's a very differential test. The court itself has not invalidated a state or local law using Pike balancing in about 25 years. And many current members of the court, Justice Scalia in particular, and also Justice Thomas, have criticized balancing as an inappropriate role for the government to, or for the court to engage in. Justice Scalia argues that it's really a quintessentially legislative activity and one ill-suited for the courts. There's been much speculation on whether the court would at some point eventually simply abandon balancing as a part of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. And while the court in Davis applied Pike balancing, it did so in a way, I think, that would give heart to Justices Thomas and Scalia that their critique of balancing is well received by other members of the court. In essence, Justice Souter questioned whether, particularly in a case like this, where delicate matters of economics and public finance are at issue, whether the court is even possesses the institutional competence to evaluate burdens and benefits. He concludes the opinion by suggesting that if any decision is to be made about whether this practice is to continue or not, that it ought to come from legislative branches, either those in the state or in Congress, which, of course, by exercising its affirmative commerce power, could prohibit states from doing this, engaging in this kind of tax exemption if it wished. Justice Kennedy dissented, and he was joined in this case only by Justice Alito. In United Haulers, Justice Alito had written the dissenting opinion was joined by Justice Kennedy and Justice Stevens. In this case, Justice Stevens joined the majority. Justice Kennedy objected to what he saw as the majority's weakening of the anti-discrimination principle and predicted that states would be emboldened by the decision to pass more protectionist laws. He also questioned whether the analogy to United Haulers was an apt one, because unlike in United Haulers, he wrote, quote, Kentucky has not monopolized the bond market or the municipal bond market. Kentucky has entered a competitive, non-monopolized market, and to give its bonds a market advantage, has taxed out-of-state municipal bonds at a higher rate, close quote. By contrast, Oneida and Herkimer counties had really monopolized the garbage processing market by building a plant that would process garbage and then prohibiting everybody from processing everybody in those counties from processing the garbage elsewhere. Well, after United Haulers, the outcome in Davis was widely expected, if not universally applauded. It's clear that the court is serious about creating a new exception to the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine. What remains unclear, however, is that exemption's scope, as well as really the basis for its creation by the court. It's still unclear, for example, why the court thinks discrimination in favor of public instrumentalities and facilities poses less of a danger to political union than discrimination in favor of their private counterparts. Justice Souter's attempt to bring this new exception under the umbrella of the market participant doctrine only adds to the confusion. Private market participants, for example, don't have the power either to force consumers to use their facilities rather than those of their competitor, nor do they have the power to wield to tax. And if the court will accept state and local invocations of the police power to excuse facial discrimination, then, as Justice Kennedy warned, such an exception might quickly swallow the rule. Only Justice Thomas is, at present, advocating such an extreme course of action, that is, the abandonment of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine, though Justice Scalia is not too far behind. But it can't be sheer coincidence that the court has pointedly curbed the anti-discrimination principle, previously regarded as the most stable and robust branch of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine, in two successive terms. As is usually the case, I suppose we won't be quite sure what Davis and United Haulers ultimately mean for the future of the Dormant Commerce Clause doctrine without more decisions. Thank you for listening to this edition of SCOTUScast. Until next time, this is Brannon Denning, Professor of Law at the Cumberland School of Law, Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, wishing you good day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUScast. For more episodes of SCOTUScast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.